Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, occasionally on American Variety, we have a show that's part of a series I call Old Florida Days. And this is one of those shows. My guest is the author of several books set in Florida, and in particular, two of them that tell the story of a Florida cattle ranching family spanning over 100 years from the very beginning of the 20th century to the early 21st century. His name is William Collier Hall, and the two books are titled Florida Boy and The Trouble with Panthers. They take place in central Florida from about Kissimmee over to Fort Pierce, which is on the east coast of Florida. Welcome, Bill.
Glad to be here, Court.
Glad to have you on. So both the books that I just mentioned tell the story of the Rawlerson family, and the first of the two, The Trouble with Panthers, was published before the other one, even though it takes place chronologically later. So the second one, Florida Boy, is actually a prequel to the first one. Now that I've probably got most of our listeners confused, let's start with Florida Boy, and let me ask you to give us just a quick overview summary of the stories of the two books together, Bill.
Okay. Well, as you said, I wrote The Trouble with Panthers first. The Rawlerson family, at that point in 2004, were already established at a big cattle ranch, and the patriarch of the family, Juli Rawlerson, is pretty much on his deathbed at the beginning of the story. In order to fill in the gaps, I decided to write Florida Boy as a prequel, which begins around 1912 in Fort Pierce, or just outside Fort Pierce, Florida. The grandfather of Juli Rawlerson is John Morgan Rawlerson. At this point in 1912, he's a teenager, and his father, James Arthur Rawlerson, they lease approximately 500 acres of land, and his father's dream has always been to own his own property and not be holding to anyone. Well, due to a series of misfortunate occurrences, John Morgan winds up the man of the family, and he wants to continue his father's dream to own property. And just while in Fort Pierce at the railroad station, he meets a young girl who is a tourist there from Missouri and immediately falls in love with her. And then when I say he falls in love with her, he's bewitched by this girl.
Yeah, he's smitten, as they used to say.
Yeah, he's smitten. But then that series of misfortunate events begins to take place within his family, and he pretty much forgets about the girl, except she has given him what he doesn't even know what it is. It's a poker chip, and it's a very valuable poker chip, and she tells him that if he brings that to Missouri, that they'll give him money for it, which seems like a foolhardy thing for him to do, but eventually he is so depressed and distressed from what's happened to his family, and he decides to go to Missouri and try to claim the money behind that chip. When he goes to Missouri to meet this girl, he finds out her name is, well, he already knew her name was Sarah, but that's all he knew. And he pretty much rescues her and brings her back to Florida.
We should say that she kind of fell in love with him, too, and it was a very curious, weird circumstance that she was brought up in, and she was being held more or less as a prisoner without even really realizing she was a prisoner because she was kidnapped as a baby by this guy, a powerful guy in Joplin, Missouri. And so he's like the first boy she's ever seen up close, and she's a teenager already. So the two of them fall in love with each other on one glance, right, but then are separated within a minute, but they still never forget each other, really. So, yeah, so take it from there. I mean, but when you say he rescued her, he literally had to because she was being held by people who are basically powerful killers, and it was a weird story. But, you know, we're not going to tell all the details, but in the course of telling the story, we're going to have to tell a lot of the story, but I think we'll intrigue our listeners enough to want to buy the two books here. So go ahead. So
he
rescues Sarah, and then at that point, he comes back to Florida, not knowing that they're on his tail. So,
yes, when he gets to Missouri, he soon learns that this girl is pretty much a prisoner, a pet of a powerful man in Joplin, Missouri. and she has never known any other life. And when John Morgan rescues her and brings her back to Florida, unbeknownst to him, they are following him. He thought that he had left no trail, but he was wrong. And ultimately, he loses his wife, Sarah, but it's after she has given birth to a son. And that son is Juli Rollerson, who will eventually become the patriarch of the Rollerson family. He is, of course, a character at the beginning of The Trouble with Panthers. And it's upon his death in The Trouble with Panthers, the Rollerson family pretty much falls apart again. The central character of that book is Bodie Rollerson. He's Juli's grandson. Then the story follows his life and some unfortunate events that happened to him are happening to a lot of ranch families in this day and age in the state of Florida.
They're kind of beset all along. I mean, by now, the second story, the second book, The Trouble with Panthers, even though it was the first one written, the second book is starting in around 2004, right? So it's almost 100 years later. But all through the whole century, they're really hardworking, determined people, smart people, but they're beset by one tragedy after another. I mean, you mentioned, you know, what happened to John Morgan, the young boy and Florida boy, and his sisters died of the Spanish flu. His father dies in an accident on horseback, and they're kicked off their land, and his mother died more or less of a broken heart. You know, one thing after another, but the guy, poor guy, and he's like a teenager still, but he's so tough and resilient enough that he manages to control his life and still move forward. But so you're starting to say about the kind of thing then that happened when the patriarch Juli died and he owned the ranch and he left it equally to all his kids. So what happened then?
Well, when Juli leaves the ranch to all his children, which is, he has two sons and a daughter. Well, the one brother and the daughter take sides against Seth Rollerson, who is Bodie's father, and force him through the courts to sell the property. And of course, they're in cahoots with a big developer, and they stand to make millions. And there's nothing that Bodie and Seth can do.
They can't afford to buy them out because it would cost them millions of dollars they don't have. So it's basically they put the squeeze on him to buy them out, and he can't, so there's a court process, as you say, to sell the property, and that's the end of the story. There's nothing he can do, as you say.
Yeah, and I should mention that in The Trouble with Panthers, besides his own family threatening to change his way of life, there is a figure who is never named that when I was writing the book, I put this figure in more or less to represent the future for people like Bodie Rollerson.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to divulge too much about this guy, but he is another thorn in Bodie's side.
He's evil. And so without going into what his impact on them is, in particular on Bodie, but he's an evil force that's stalking Bodie in addition to everything else that's collapsing around his ears. So.
Right. Yeah, and I should mention there's another character in the story who is a very elderly Native American who also, none of the Rollersons ever knew this guy's name, but they refer to him as Solomon because he seems to know the book of Ecclesiastes by heart. And he constantly uses phrases from Ecclesiastes. Well, this elderly Indian is a very wise person, but he is a key player in the story as far as Bodie goes, and he will be a key player later if I get busy and write the book.
Yeah, so, you know, one aside, I grew up in Central Florida, actually. We went to high school in Fort Pierce, and I knew some Rollersons who are ranchers. So I suppose that it's a coincidence and that even though it's spelled a little differently, the the Rawlerson family that you're tracking through these two books is no relation, I don't think, to the actual Rawlerson cattle ranching family of Central Florida, huh?
No. I changed the spelling of Rawlerson deliberately because there are a lot of pioneer Rawlersons across the state of Florida.
That's right.
My dad grew up with a Rawlerson over in Polk County, and they had been there since the 1800s. The Rawlersons out of Fort Pierce and the north edge of Lake Okeechobee, I don't know if they're related to the Rawlersons in Polk County, but very possibly could be.
I think they are.
This isn't pertinent to the story, but I used to own property in Osceola County that butted up against a Rawlerson ranch, about 17,000 acres in that ranch. But that gentleman lost the ranch. The federal government took it. And I won't say why.
Okay. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author William Collier Hall, Bill Hall, who's written a number of books, but two of them in particular we're talking with him about today, Florida Boy and The Trouble with Panthers, that tell sequentially the story of the Rawlerson cattle ranching family in Florida, starting around a little after 1900 and going up to a little after the 2000s, so 2004 or so. So really, you know, as you said earlier, Bill, the core of the story is the pressure to sell from the siblings, in this case, to sell the ranch for development after the patriarch July dies. And that story, I think you said, has been repeating itself in real life across the interior of Florida for decades. I mean, every drop in beef prices, every citrus-killing freeze, each new wave of retirees and newcomers all bring tremendous change to the large landholdings, which get harder and harder to hold and harder to make a living on. Your characters in the book, The Trouble with Panthers, use the term the switch point. What's the switch point? That's a key point.
The switch point is I'm not sure who coined that phrase. It's the point where the value of the property exceeds any occupation that you can use that property for. Land around, especially around the Disney World area, has become so expensive that you just can't afford to raise cattle on it. Mm-hmm. It's a losing proposition. Here in Brevard County, where I live, the Duda Ranch, which is, I'm almost on the edge of it, or what it, where it used to be, it was over 50,000 acres, and now it is a city. When the patriarch of that family passed away, the siblings got together, formed a corporation, and developed it. It's something I hated to see, but of course I have no control over it.
Well, you know, in a sense, it's kind of inevitable when you've got a number of kids. In the case of this particular ranch belonging to the Rawlersons in your book, only one son named Seth and his son named Bodie love the ranching lifestyle. But the daughter and the other brother don't care about it at all. And yet, they all inherit it equally. So if only the son who loves the ranch gets to keep it, the other two, in effect, get disinherited. They get nothing. So it's kind of not fair on the one hand. And yet, there's a certain unfairness in forcing the one who loves it to sell out. But, you know, what can you do? It's kind of a train wreck. And so that happens, too. And in fact, that happens all over the world with large land-owning families. I mean, it happens in Europe where people own large estates or maybe large vineyards and that kind of thing. So land is forced to be broken up by inheritance and by the, you know, the pressure of taxes and that kind of thing too. So, you know, so it's kind of a process that you just can't stop, and it's going to go on and on. And eventually the big land holdings, the big cattle ranches will diminish in number. But do you know about how many big ranches remain in Florida today?
Well, there's approximately 15,000 beef producers left in Florida.
Wow.
As far as large holdings, Deseret Ranch, which is owned by the Mormons, and it's spread all over Osceola County into Orange County, It's the largest ranch in the U.S.
Is that right?
Still is.
I'll be darned.
But it's my understanding that they are selling.
Hmm.
They're selling off portions of the ranch, and they're buying property up in the panhandle of Florida from the what used to be the Port St. Joe Paper Company.
Hmm.
Yeah, the Mormon ranch initially was over 1 million acres, but it's diminished over the years, and I think now it was up around 300,000 acres. But a cattle family that I'm very familiar with are the Tuckers of Brevard County, and they told me about this even before I read, before it was common knowledge that the Mormons were moving.
Hmm.
And it's because of the value of the land.
Sure.
They butt up against the Orlando International Airport and almost to Disney.
Yeah.
They can't afford to keep it.
Yeah.
So they moved up into the panhandle where development hadn't been quite as fierce as it is around here.
Yeah, yet anyway. But when you're being offered $100,000 an acre, it's hard to turn away when you're hard pressed to even make $100,000 a year on your ranch. So do the remaining ranchers make much profit in an average year in general?
I think they do quite well.
All right.
The information I read on Deseret, this was from 2015, that they estimated that their profit for that year was $16 million for that ranch. But that's a big operation.
Yeah.
Actually, I thought that seemed kind of low. But, and it's a church-owned operation. I think they don't pay any taxes.
That helps
a
lot.
So they have an advantage over the average guy.
Yeah, they sure do. That's kind of seems unfair, doesn't it? But anyway, so, I mean, the ranches that I knew, and I did know some ranchers and the kids of ranchers when I was growing up in Fort Pierce back in the mid to late 60s, and they were 15,000 to 30,000 acres for the most part, but I imagine most of those no longer exist. And those that have probably have diversified. And this is one of the sub-themes in your book, The Trouble with Panthers, is that the next-door ranch, Bodie ends up being in love with a young girl there, and she with him, and they end up getting married. And her family farm has diversified into selling sod and other kinds of things and citrus, you know, so they don't put all their eggs in the one basket of cattle because it's too risky and the market is too fragile, you know.
Yeah, virtually all the ranches that I'm familiar with have diversified.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from selling hunting rights to every possible way that they can add to the income, they're doing it.
And that's part of the kind of the theme, really, the underlying theme of The Trouble with Panthers is that July, the old patriarch, just before he dies, tells his grandson, Bodie, that the trouble with panthers is they don't know how to change. They see a panther on their property, which neither of them has ever seen before. They're so rare. And he said they're just dying out because they can't change. And it's, Bodie, you've got to change. Us ranchers, the old guys, we're not changing, but you've got to change or you will die out too. And that's kind of his point, that you've got to evolve, and that's the trouble with panthers. They can't evolve. So that's kind of the story
right,
there. But
exactly.
There's a rifle that figures as almost a silent character in both novels. In fact, it's on the cover of Florida Boy and is kind of the chapter icon heading for Trouble with Panthers. And John Morgan, the great-grandfather of Bodie, took it from the murderous bodyguard when he rescued Sarah back in the first, in the book Florida Boy. And nearly a century later, Bodie is nearly killed for that rifle that he still keeps as just his kind of rifle, you know. So tell us a little bit about that particular rifle.
Yeah, that rifle is a Winchester, model 1873. You've probably heard of it, the gun that won the West. And it's a one of 1,000, which is a very valuable weapon. I think the last time I checked, they're worth anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000
mm-hmm.
just for that one rifle.
Yeah. I looked it up, too, and the one in 1,000 means that Winchester took out of production one rifle out of 1,000 and rifled it specially, put a different, you know, put special hardware on it to make it super accurate. So it's basically of an already rare and famous weapon. It's the one in 1,000 best of those, and there are only a handful of them known to exist. So, like you say, they're worth upwards of $500,000, and that's part of he didn't realize that, but he was being hunted for it, kind of, you know.
Yes, in the year 2004 and 2005, he is being hunted, doesn't even know it,
right.
for that rifle.
And I should say that I was born in Miami, but from the ages of 14 through 18, as I said, in high school, kind of ninth grade through high school, I lived in Fort Pierce. And I had a very adventurous life there, you know, fishing and surfing and hunting. I really loved it. And I got to know, as I mentioned, some of the ranching families out west of town and spent a lot of time in the pine woods and cypress hammocks with old-time Florida people. I even hung out with a Seminole family who had an encampment out there that I ran across out in the woods. And they just kind of let me sit around the edge of their of their family encampment for a while and just kind of immerse myself in what they were doing, you know. They put up with me. I was 15 or 16, I guess. But the dialogue in these books, this is my point, is very real. I mean, it's exactly like I remember. I mean, these people in your books talk exactly like I remember these people talking. It's so real. I can just, you know, put it in my head very easily. So how did you come to know so intimately how cattle ranchers think and talk? I know you said you know one family, but have you been immersed in that world for a long time yourself, Bill?
Yes. Yeah, when I was in high school, in the summers, I used to do contract mowing for a big ranch over in Polk County, the Yule Ranch. I think it no longer exists. And the young fellows that grew up on that ranch, I went to school with and was really good friends with them. And we'd hang around the cow pens, and so I heard a lot of old cowboys talk.
Yeah, it comes through for sure. And I think they still talk pretty much now. Those few who are left still talk the way they did 50 years ago, I suspect. And not a lot of change.
Yeah, the cover of The Trouble with Panthers, the fellow that's sitting that horse, that's he's a young fellow that I've known since he was 6, 7 years old.
Hmm.
I asked him, and he still is a working cowboy. I asked him if he'd pose for the picture, and he said, sure, as long as you don't show my face. Typical cowboy.
Yeah, it's a neat photograph. He's in silhouette on a horseback, shot from behind, looking out over a lake. But what I notice is in the distance, very subtly, there's a cell tower. Was that on purpose?
Yes.
Was it?
You weren't supposed to notice that.
Well, I think it's actually pretty good because it shows that world, and yet off in the distance, here's that modern world that's encroaching on them, right? So to me, it's...
Right.
I figured it was intentional, so we'll pretend that you did it on purpose.
That's good with me.
All right. Well, Bill, you didn't start to write until late in life, I know, and you told me, you know, quite late. So how did that happen, just briefly?
In 1997, my best friend, who's a fellow that I fish and hunt with, he had a very interesting occurrence when he was on a hunting trip. And I told him, I said, you know, you should write that. You could probably sell that to the outdoor magazines. Well, he never did. So I did, and I sold it and realized that, I enjoy this. I wrote a few articles, and I think I was published in 3 different magazines.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, if I did that, I guess I could write a book, too. That's why I did it. The first book I wrote was called September's Fawn, and I self-published it, but it did really good. As a matter of fact, it still sells.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote it in 2003. And the Historical Society saw that book and they seemed to like it. So I took my manuscript for The Trouble with Panthers to them, and they bought it. They published it.
So before you wrote that one story, you know, was it kind of always in the back of your mind, Bill, where you always wanted to write but just didn't have time, or did it just suddenly pop up out of nowhere when that opportunity arose?
When I was in high school, I enjoyed writing short stories. And I had a professor when I was in college that encouraged me to continue it, which I guess went in one ear and out the other, because mm-hmm. life got in the way and I just completely forgot about it.
Hmm. Did it surprise you once you started that you actually could do it well and people liked what you wrote?
Yes. It,
short answer, yes.
It did surprise me.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I'm glad the opportunity arose, because the books you're writing are very good, and I would certainly recommend them. Both your books and your background remind me of the famed Florida author Patrick Smith, who's best known for the novel A Land Remembered, which takes place in a similar setting with similar people. And actually, he was a guest on American Variety back in our early days. But I'd say your books are very, very much every bit as good as his. And both novels, as you say, these ones that we're talking about, were published by the Florida Historical Society Press. And The Trouble with Panthers, which was published in 2010, won the gold medal for popular fiction of the Florida Humanities Council in 2011. And then Florida Boy was published in 2015. So we just have and they're both available on Amazon and the usual outlets. But, you know, we just have a minute or so left, Bill. So what's next for you as a writer?
Well, I've started a third book, which will be chronologically located between Florida Boy and The Trouble with Panthers. And I'm going to, from that point on, I'm going to refer to the three books as the Kissimmee Valley Trilogy.
Okay.
Hopefully I can do this one justice, and it's my intention to make the protagonist the elderly Indian, which Bodie calls Solomon.
Yeah.
He will be the central character.
Yeah, he's almost in The Trouble with Panthers. He's like a mystical figure in a way. Kind of, some people don't even believe he exists, but, you know, and Bodie only half believes he has seen and talked with him, because he kind of disappears like smoke, and even the sign that he was there disappears. So it's it's kind of, he's like mythical in a way, and he kind of brings in the ancient Florida into the picture in the body of a person who's still alive. But so that should be interesting.
Funny you should say that. Into the Mist is the title of the book I'm working on, where the old Indian is the central character.
Yeah, okay, well, that fits. Well, it's been great having you on, Bill. I want to thank you, and also thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.